Action Phase. I'm your host, Tegan Keating. This week, I talk with Joe Pyle. He is the president of the Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation. We talk about lots of behavioral health type stuff. I mean, he just defines behavioral health, first of all. And, we talk about why behavioral health is important to integrate as part of our understanding of overall health and by extension into medical care, rather than just focusing on physical ailments, also making sure that people are healthy mentally. We also talk about decreasing stigma and increasing literacy about behavioral health. And basically what that means is that the Scattergood Foundation is trying to work towards normalizing the idea that mental illness is, or behavioral health issues are, just part of everyday life. And Joe gives us some really interesting and kind of shocking statistics about the percentage of people in the United States who will be diagnosed with mental illness each year and then over the course of their lifetime. So, I encourage you to take a look at that and, or listen, really. It's a podcast. Joe and I had a really great conversation, and I think that you'll enjoy it. Here he is, Joe Pyle. I'm here with Joe Pyle, the president of the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, Tegan. How are you?
Thanks. Thanks for taking some time out of your morning to talk with me.
My pleasure.
So, what is Scattergood? What does it do? Why does it exist? All of that kind of stuff.
Sure. So, the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation is a health conversion foundation that was formed back in 2005, and it was the result of a partnership that was formed with Friends Hospital and a healthcare provider. And as a result of that partnership that was formed, a small foundation was created. And since the work of Friends Hospital had been in the area of behavioral health, the foundation's primary work is in the field of behavioral health.
And what does behavioral health mean in this context?
Well, behavioral health can mean a lot of different things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So the way the foundation views its role is that we believe behavioral health, and I'll get to what we mean by that, needs to be reintegrated back into health care.
Mm-hmm.
For probably the last 20 years, how we've thought about mental illness and substance abuse, which are the two main components when you use the word behavioral health,
mm-hmm.
has been as a carve out, that there have been providers of those services that are not part of the mainstream insurance provider network,
right.
Not part of the mainstream health delivery system. So the word carve out has been used. And we really believe that in order to see the kind of change in both the delivery system and in the outcomes that we need to see in the folks in the communities that we serve, we really need to integrate behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse back into how we think about the whole body.
Mm-hmm. Because you really can't separate physical and mental health.
You can't, though I would say the last 20 years were an experiment on trying to do that.
But and a failure?
But
maybe not a failure.
I would say that there's a lot you could say that was a failure in it. I think it did bring attention and dollars to special populations. I think people that have chronic and persistent mental health conditions have benefited from creating carve-outs that really have brought the dollars
mm-hmm.
to those communities that were tremendously underserved in the past. So I think that what's happened, though, has been an evolution of science that we now know that for a lot of chronic health conditions, if we don't treat the comorbid behavioral health condition, we won't see the health outcomes that like, we need to what, say.
What's an example of that?
So in the area of cardiac care, we know that if you don't treat underlying depression or depression that may be a result of a cardiac event, that your mortality rate increases significantly to the point now where a large percentage of cardiac programs will include behavioral health intervention pre-treatment as well as post-treatment. That the data is, you know, really strong there. I mean, we also see it on other chronic health conditions like asthma and diabetes, and compliance becomes an important issue, so that if there's other things happening to you emotionally, you are less likely to take the medication and take care of yourself.
Right.
So that's where the correlation comes in. So you're seeing more and more primary care specialty programs looking at the impact that behavioral health interventions, therapeutic counseling interventions, or medication interventions can have on improving health outcomes.
That sounds great to me. And then what does Scattergood do to work towards that?
So, you know, we're a very small foundation. So when we look at where we can have impact, we think about where we can be involved in system transformation, mm-hmm. how we can get people to think about the delivery system differently. So one area that we're probably most known for, and it's because of the good work of Mike and Scott.
I know about the Scattergood Foundation because of WHYY.
So we approached over 5 years ago WHYY with this idea that we did not think the way behavioral health was being reported did the readers of publications or the listeners to programs on air, didn't give them the right information. It didn't do the situation justice. And we approached HYY and said, we'd like to fund a full-time reporter to cover behavioral health. So Mike was hired and has done a phenomenal job, and this year was received an award from the Philadelphia Alliance, which is the consortium of behavioral health organizations across the city, for her, you know, high level of achievement in reporting. So the foundation's role there is, how do we get information out about mental health in a way that's informative, that's fair and balanced, and is on a broad spectrum? I mean, too often when media covers mental health, it's related to a crisis.
Right.
It's related to an act of violence that then we say the person had a mental health issue. Or it's our connection to seeing people that have chronic persistent mental illness and are homeless, that we don't talk about it across a much broader spectrum. And I think Mikan's done a phenomenal job, and HYY's done a phenomenal job of kind of building her desk, her reports, into something of real value for the community.
And now they have the Pulse, right?
Exactly. So that's exciting. So that they have a health and science desk that they've had, I guess, for about 5 years, and it's grown in the number of reporters and in its scope. And now they have a special one-hour show once a week called The Pulse, which is very on-the-ground reporting. But what's really exciting is that the host of that is their behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott.
Right, yeah.
So for us, you know, she not only continues to cover behavioral health, but she also brings to the work as the host that lens of behavioral mm-hmm. health. So if she's covering an issue on breast cancer, let's say, she's able to not only talk about the science of breast cancer, but then also brings in what impact might breast cancer have
right.
on the individual woman, the family, her partner. So she's able to kind of take it to another level. So we're excited that she's doing the Pulse. And we're also excited that, you know, she's done such a fantastic job for us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an avid WHYY listener, so Mike and Scott, I know when I didn't realize that her beat was primarily or almost entirely behavioral health, but I always loved what she had to say, so it makes sense because it's interesting
stuff. Well, and not to be doing a commercial for Mike and WHYY, but I think what she's done, and I think this is the conversation that the foundation would really hope that happens across the city and the area, is that she's having a conversation about the whole person, mm-hmm. about how can one achieve to a higher level. And that's what the foundation really wants. And I think it comes at it by saying that if we don't really understand the emotional connection, the science of our brain in a better way and the way it affects us on a daily basis, that we're not going to be the next great city. We're not going to get the things done that we all want. So it's great that you don't necessarily see her as the behavioral health reporter all the time, but I think all of her stories bring in a behavioral health component to them. So I'm hoping that people are listening to them and saying, maybe I should consider this.
Right.
Or maybe that's my son that she's talking about, and maybe I should seek to get care for my son or daughter or myself,
right.
or another family member.
It seems like of all of the different issues that come that are health related that are in the news, that behavioral health is probably one of the more complicated for people to understand, and you know, very stigmatized, which I know we got to talk about stigma. But first, you mentioned that mental illness is generally talked about in regards to a crisis that happens, which kind of reminded me of my own issue with the, we don't need to worry about guns, we need to worry about mental health and mental illness. And I was wondering what you think about that.
Well, when, you know, I separate out the two of those issues for myself. I think that guns are a problem in our society, and we need to think about, you know, what is the right balance and where do the civil liberties of gun ownership come in. So I think the gun crisis in this country is one that needs to be addressed, I think, parallel or separate from the mental health conversation. And then I think because the mental health conversation becomes joined with the gun crisis in this country, I think what we really need to be talking about is, are we providing access to care, access to services to individuals so that the gun crisis and mental health crisis never need to happen together?
Right.
So what are those early intervention programs that may be needed for people who may commit acts of violence? How do we engage them? How do we identify them? How do we provide other members in the community with skills to know that, you know, Joe may be having a crisis, and how do we get him the services that he needs,
mm-hmm.
rather than saying people with mental health issues can be violent and hence we should treat them differently, so we don't really have to get, and this is my personal politics on this, that we don't have to get to the issue of, you know, why do we have so many guns in this country?
It's kind of burying the issue about guns, at least, by shifting the conversation over to mental health. Not addressing more. There's a lot going on with this stuff. It's not just one thing.
There's a ton of stuff going on, and I don't claim to be smart enough to have nearly half of the solution. but I think that we really do find ourselves in an interesting place, because it is easy, because of issues of stigma, to make this a mental health conversation. And if we say that people with mental health issues can't own guns, then it's really not about the issue of, do we just have too many guns in this country?
Right.
I mean, we all know the statistics in Philadelphia about the acts of violence that are committed on a regular basis, the amount of murders that are committed, those are questions of poverty and education, and maybe just there are too many guns out there.
Yeah, it's I certainly didn't expect you to have any answers, and it's a very complex issue. But I'm pleased to hear you say that for yourself, you separate out those two issues, because there's always been something that's like rubbed me the wrong way about talking about guns as if the only problem is that some people have mental illness and therefore can't be trusted. It seems more
exactly, and it needs to be thought about in a way that at some point the issues do need to come back together. So, mm-hmm. you know, there may be people that have mental health issues that should not own a gun.
Right.
And we need to build those safeguards in for those individuals and for the community. But it shouldn't start with, we have a mental health crisis in this country, and if we don't give guns to those people, we won't have a gun crisis.
Right.
I don't think it works quite that simply.
Yeah. So I know that you also work a lot on stigma reduction and that kind of thing. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We have started to spend a whole lot more attention on how does mental health literacy and mental health stigma really impact the range of services that are being provided. So by way of a little background, the statistics are at a very simple level that 1 in 4 of us in any given year can have a diagnosable mental illness. That in our lifetime it goes above 50% of people could have a diagnosable mental health condition. So it's very common, though it doesn't get the conversation about its impact that other disorders, diseases get that are far less prevalent. And when you look at the economics of mental health disorders, that I want to say it's either the number one or number two cause of disability.
Can we back up for a second? When you say mental health disorders, we're talking about everything from depression, anxiety, to bipolar, to schizophrenia, to anything
else.
I'm
talking about it in a very broad category.
Right.
We're not talking about just bipolar disorder or depression.
Right.
We're talking about everything that is in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM-5, which is another podcast in and of itself.
It is. I just read yesterday that caffeine withdrawal is now in there.
I couldn't answer that, but it wouldn't surprise me. So we've kind of come at this to say that what role does stigma play in mental health services being not as effective as they can be? So what you start to look at is that the prejudice and stereotypes that exist in the world around behavioral health prevent people from seeking treatment.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So people are afraid to be labeled as being weak, as being, just get over that.
Mm-hmm.
That's really not a real condition. It's, behave differently.
Right. If you just like open your windows and get out of bed, everything will be okay.
Exactly. So the first step is really to say that we need to recognize that this stigma has to be changed, transformed. The other piece is that it has a huge impact, stigma does, on people staying in care. So once you're in care, you're receiving treatment, therapy, if the stigma doesn't get addressed, your retention is very low. On a percentage basis, it's really significant, the number of people that drop out of therapy.
I was just going to say, I know so many people who have started they go for a couple weeks, couple months, and then they're like, I don't need this anymore.
Well, and part of that is that if you're in therapy, that it can be very hard work.
Right,
It can be hard work, and it also can be costly. And the reimbursement, the copay, can be a bit overwhelming for people. So mm-hmm. you have, one, I want to be in care. Do I have access to that care? Can I afford it? And is it the right therapy modality for me to get treatment? Do I need a course of medication? Should I be in psychotherapy? Should I be in some alternative form of treatment? So I think that it is a complication there. But one aspect of stigma is just the stigma that we put on ourselves when we have a mental health diagnosis. So self-stigma can prevent us from moving forward. So what we've done in this last year that's been exciting is that Tim Clements, who is a recent graduate of the Drexel School of Public Health and did his master's project with us last year, really made this point to me that if we asked our grantees to think about how their organization either increases stigma or decreases stigma, we could be more effective without spending a significant amount of money within the grant. And it really did cause me to think about maybe we need to be doing some education on this for the local community and for our grantees. So back in July, Tim came on a one-year fellowship to look at how to increase community engagement to decrease stigma and increase literacy. And he's been at it now, well, I guess it's almost 6 months, and I think is starting to have some impact in, one, people are calling him and saying, come out and talk to my organization about what you're trying to do. And then we're also seeing organizations that he goes out to saying, maybe we need a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And people are recognizing, even though I'm a mental health provider, I may not be behaving in a way that is best for the clients and the individuals that I serve. So we're going to chase after this. We're going to try to build literacy around mental health and hopefully get organizations to think about how they can decrease stigma within their own organization. And again, it's one of those things that as science has progressed in mental health over the 30 years that I've been in this work, there's still a lot of art and there's a lot of debate about what works, what doesn't. And so this whole question about should we be really trying to lower stigma and increase literacy, there's a real debate in the community.
Really? There are people who think that the stigmas, or that there isn't stigma, or that...
I think people would recognize that there is stigma, and I think everybody would recognize there's a lack of literacy. I think people would say, is that really what we should be doing first?
Mm.
That should we be providing services? And I think it's a balance. I think we need, obviously, more dollars going into effective treatment.
Right.
But I also think that if some of the underlying conditions aren't right in that service delivery, it can be doing damage. There's nothing worse than somebody seeking treatment and feeling like they're not getting they're not being welcome for who they are,
mm-hmm.
and that there's some perception that they're bad. And I think it happens more often than we think as providers of behavioral health, mental health services. We probably could all do a better job on that.
Of being more accepting.
More accepting.
Yeah. So let's shift a little bit and let's talk about you. How did you get involved in mental behavioral health, all that kind of stuff? What grabbed you at first?
So I started out, graduated from LaSalle with an undergraduate degree in special ed, and my first job was teaching middle school special ed class of socially and emotionally disturbed middle schoolers in a urban school district, and realized as a teacher I was totally unequipped.
Oh, really?
For the emotional needs that were happening in the classroom.
When you say emotional issues, what do you mean by that?
You know, a lot of these kids were coming from single parent homes, homes where there may have been abuse or neglect within various levels within the family, economic stressors on the family. So, you know, the kids were coming with significant learning disabilities, but they were also coming with some significant adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I might have learned how to teach reading to somebody with dyslexia, but not then around some of the behavioral issues that were coming up in the classroom. The truancy that may have been a result of their wanting to be home, not because of their embarrassment about not being able to read, but because they had a caretaker mom.
Right.
So I pretty quickly learned that I wasn't going to be an effective teacher unless I learned more about what was really happening to them emotionally, mm-hmm. behaviorally. So I went back to graduate school to get a degree in school psychology, and that led me to go work at the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic a long time ago, and worked as a clinician for a number of years, and then over time moved into more administrative positions. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've always, you know, I loved when I was a teacher, loved when I was a clinician, and though that was more one-to-one, and over time as I moved into more administrative roles, you still have an impact on individuals, and maybe you have a greater impact if you can build out a quality organization.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I think in this role of, you know, running a small foundation, the question is, can we convene individuals around important questions and get people to think about how people with mental health issues are perceived and how they receive services. So, you know, my evolution has been as a direct service provider,
mm-hmm.
to now somebody who hopefully can listen, reflect on, you know, what are the issues of the day, and put a small amount of dollars, you know, at the right point to get change to happen. So that's kind of how I come to it.
How has being a mental health professional and then a behavioral health administrator affected your understanding of mental health, like in your own personal life? Do you find that people come to you when they're having an issue and they're like, Joe, I don't know what's going on, but I need help? Like, do you see any of that? Or
probably. I mean, I think as a former provider of services and a person who ran, you know, a large institutions that provided mental health services, I'm often called by people to say, I need to get services for a family member. Can you recommend somebody?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've continued to be seen as a resource. I think how it's impacted me in my own life is maybe slowed me down a little bit to think about my interactions with other people, what might be happening to someone that I'm working with, so that my behavior, I hope that I'm a little bit more respectful of how my behavior may be influencing other people.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that in your family, people are more inclined to seek mental health services because of the work that you do? Like, do you have like a positive influence on your family members? Or they're just doing their own thing. They don't care what you do.
If I think about my family, I'm probably, you know, the ineffective one. I think it's something we talk about. So I would hope that my family would see it as, you know, something that's, you know, good to do if one needs to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it a lot, but I'm not sure that it's had a significant halo effect on every family member that I know and love.
I always wonder about that when people have really dedicated their life to one particular issue, if the people around them kind of absorb that also, or if it's just like with any other job, you kind of like don't pay attention to what your brother or your dad is doing. You know, like you're kind of like, oh man, he's going to work. Doesn't matter to me.
I think there's a lot of that. I think if you, you know, just take it as a snippet for a second, that with, I think it's about 18% of the gross national product being in healthcare these days, and you look at how unhealthy the healthcare workforce is.
I would say
that, you know, we probably don't have the influence over others that we would like to. So, yeah.
So unfortunately.
So it is just going to work. Yeah. He's just going to work.
Yeah, I guess because, you know, you hear of lawyers always being asked for legal advice and doctors like, oh, can you diagnose this like weird thing on my skin and things like that. So I wonder with mental health if that kind of happens as well.
Well, I think I don't get asked to diagnose somebody's, you know, mental health condition. I do think it comes up much more often in the conversation. So, and what's interesting is that we've been wearing, folks at the foundation, board members, a small button that has 26% on it, mm-hmm. which is the number of, it's that 1 in 4.
Right.
And it comes closer to 26% than 25%.
I think so, we can let you round up.
So we, we've been wearing this button, and it's very nondescript.
Yeah, it's like a real, I saw it on the desk once. Yes. It's like really little.
But there's not a week that goes by that several people don't ask me, what does the 26% mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, oh, do you run in a marathon?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it raises, and when I talk about it, inevitably, it leads to a conversation with people.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation is about how mental health, substance abuse issues have affected their life.
Right.
So I think we're all wanting the conversation to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think there has not been a permission given to have it, because I think people are afraid they'll be labeled, they'll
right.
be stereotyped, there'll be a stigma that's placed on them. So I guess what I hope happens is that people find me accessible on the issue, and that allows for more open conversation. So one role, going back to the foundation, is that we really hope that we can leverage the dollars that we give to get other people to pay attention to this issue. And I think the way to do that is you have to be a good partner.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be willing to be flexible on the issue a bit, that to be to dig in your heels, I think at this stage prevents a greater number of people coming to the conversation. So you have to be willing to give a little bit on the edges and to move the conversation ahead. I mean, for a long time in this country, we fought for parity, and I'm not sure you can legislate parity. I think the parity will come when the conversation is happening in every general practitioner's office. So when he asks you, how are you doing, he's looking for more than just, oh, everything's fine.
Right.
You know, when you're talking about your insomnia, might he be asking you what else is happening in your life?
Mm-hmm.
Make that referral. Or maybe he even has somebody within his practice that is a behavioral health specialist that can see you before you leave to talk about
mm-hmm.
some of those stressors in your life that may be causing you to have your chronic health condition be exacerbated. So
that sounds like a really awesome, ideal world. To be able to have all of that stuff integrated and everybody is okay with talking about it. And
well, you probably should interview a health economist on this, but I think that if we could get to that point of integration, I think that the savings to the health system would be significant. And then I think we could be putting those dollars into things that would be, you know, good for all of us.
Right.
So I think that there's a level of ineffectiveness in the healthcare delivery system that a more holistic, integrated approach could have a significant impact on decreasing cost, and then taking those dollars and putting them into, whether it's into research or into prevention, I think is would be a great thing to have happen.
So I think that anybody who listens to this is going to be totally fascinated by what Scattergood does, and is, you know, I think that anybody who's interested in public health in general is going to be into this. So how can people learn more about what the foundation does, and like what's the best way to get in touch with you guys?
Sure. So the best way to get in touch with us is through our website. So mm-hmm. if you go to www.scattergoodfoundation.org, I think we have a really, I think we have a powerful website. Our website provides an opportunity for all of our grantees to talk about their work, I think, in a very unique way. We believe in total transparency in grant making. So not only do our grantees apply online, but they report online.
Mm.
So all the outcomes of their work are in the public domain.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah,
that's
we great. Think we're one of a few, or the only one, who really does it at the level that we do. So the website shows our work, and we would hope that your interest in our in this public health debate around integration of behavioral health into primary care and into healthcare in general is evident on our website, and that you can connect organizations that you think are really important. So we work with organizations around domestic violence. So if that's something that's interesting to you, if you're in the journalism space, go look at what Mikan's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. John Rich, we were the founding funder for the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice.
Oh,
so
okay.
If you're into those issues, you know, go learn more about John's work. So we hope that our website is a place where people can come and find something that may be of particular interest to them, and go meet our grantees and learn about their work.
That sounds great. It sounds like a really good resource for anybody who's interested at all in mental behavioral health.
I would hope so. I mean, I I'd welcome people, if they have criticisms about the website or the work, to leave a comment there, and we'll get back to them.
Constructive criticism, not just like, this is stupid.
Well,
thank you so much for talking with me.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Joe.
All right, you're welcome.
So there he is, Joe Pyle, the president of the Thomas Scattergood Foundation. He's leading the charge to reduce stigma about mental health issues, and helping, you know, basically providing money to other organizations to do their good work. So this week's action item is to try to decrease stigma in your own life. And the way that you can do this is by being open with one person about a struggle that you've had. Just talking to them about it. I mean, it doesn't have to be, I'm in the middle of a crisis, let me tell you about it. But, you know, for here's my example. I'll start. So I, after a bunch of family events, had a really hard time with depression and anxiety, and have been, you know, in treatment for it for a long time, a couple years now. And I have found it to be incredibly beneficial to not only my mental health dealing with those particular issues, but just in general, just taking time out of my life every week to listen to and address my own concerns and problems. Is it's been really important to me and helpful. And I encourage anybody who is going through a difficult time to reach out to, you know, a mental health professional, a counselor or psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever, float your boat, and talk to that person and figure out what's going on, and, you know, get the help that you need. So now that I've shared that intimate knowledge with you. Now I expect you to talk to somebody else about something that you've dealt with. It doesn't have to be mental health. It could be something else. But, you know, if you've had some depression in your past or, you know, a touch of anxiety here and there, tell somebody about what that experience was like and how you are either still struggling with it or how you've, you know, learned and grown from that experience. You know, take this stigma reduction into your own hands and start talking to people about it. And you'd be surprised. I know that when I have talked to some people about my own issues, I've heard from a lot of people about the things that they've been dealing with. And, you know, it's kind of not great to say, but it kind of makes you feel good that, like, somebody is willing to share that deep of an issue with you just because you told them about your own issues. It's kind of remarkable. So I encourage you to do that this week. And so thanks so much, and I will talk to you soon. Thanks so much for listening to Action Phase. You can find me, Tegan, on Twitter at Tegan Keating. That's TEAGANKEATING. And on my site, TeganK.com. You can find Action Phase on Twitter at Action Phase Pod and on ActionPhasePodcast.com. You can feel free to email me at ActionPhasePodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.